It's time. It's time to open your eyes. It's time to open your mind. It's time to grow up and face reality. It's time to lock and load because it's Meat Trapper time.
Assassinate real news. They use their schools to teach children that their president is another Hitler. They use their movie stars and singers and comedy shows and award shows to repeat their narrative over and over again. And then they use their ex-president to endorse the resistance, all to make them march, make them protest, make them scream racism and sexism and xenophobia and homophobia, to smash windows, burn cars, shut down interstates and airports, bully and terrorize the law-abiding, until the only option left is for the police to do their jobs and stop the madness. And when that happens, they'll use it as an excuse for their outrage. The only way we stop this, the only way we save our country and our freedom, is to fight this violence of lies with the clenched fist of truth. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a high altitude edition of Meat Trapper Radio. And I say high altitude because today I am on top of a local mountain at the very peak, and there is a huge, huge rock outcropping that I'm sitting on top of, looking out over God's creation. It's interesting because it's a very chilly day, especially for this time of the year. And we've got a light drizzly rain, and I'm up sort of in the clouds where it's misty, just sort of misty and damp. And being stupid, I didn't bring any rain gear with me. And so we don't want you to be stupid like me. So, talking about not being stupid, the first thing that you need to do that is smart is, if you're looking for snares or trapping supplies, check out southernsnares.com. Give Jeff a call down there. He doesn't bite. He loves to talk snaring and trapping, and he'll give you the straight scoop. So if you're looking for anything, check out southernsnares.com, and I promise you, he makes very, very good snares. So today we're going to talk about a couple of different things. In the last episode, I talked about AR-15s and tactical gear setups, you know, gear for the common man, and all of that. And that generated a lot of feedback. And so today, the first thing, excuse me if I'm out of breath because these hills are steep and I ain't getting any younger. But the first thing I want to share with you today is feedback from a couple of our combat vets. And that's what I love about this audience, is the diversity of experience. And this is not a bunch of wannabe people, you know, that are spouting off a lot of survival commando internet forum nonsense. These are guys that have been and done. So anyway, without further ado, and instead of me rattling on, the first thing I'd like to do is share some feedback from Barry. And Barry wrote me about some of the experiences he had coming under mortar fire in Iraq. And just to refresh people, if you don't remember, you didn't listen, I was talking about wearing your mag pouches on your hips or on the side of your vest and not stacking them, double stacking them across the front, preventing you from laying prone and all of that. So anyway, Barry says, you're spot on about not mounting magazines on your chest. One night while I was in Iraq, I was walking out to the airfield to pull stuck screws on an F-16 when our base came under rocket and mortar attack. I heard the first rounds whistling overhead in the air before they impacted, and I dove to the ground. I had my IFAC kit, my mag pouches mounted on my chest, on my body armor. During the attack, a mortar round impacted close to where I was laying and peppered the small concrete barrier wall about 10 yards to my left with shrapnel. I tried to crawl to a depression in front of me that was about an inch lower than where I was laying. The gear mounted on my chest made it difficult and did not let me lay as low as I wanted to. It honestly felt like I was laying with my chest on top of a volleyball. I felt very exposed and was terrified that I was going to get hit by shrapnel. It's funny now, but not being able to lay as low on the ground as possible for those few minutes definitely kept me much more exposed than I needed to be and gave me one of the biggest scares of my life. The episode made me think about that moment. Even though I was carrying it in a stupid place, I was happy to be carrying an IFAC kit, individual first aid kit. I carried it everywhere I went over there. I noticed you said you only had ammo mounted on your load-bearing equipment. Do you carry a first aid kit? And if not, what? Just my opinion here, but even while out patrolling a neighborhood for looters, I would want to have some kind of first aid kit. I'd at least want a tourniquet in a pocket in case one of those looters got in a lucky shot. Just curious. Take care, Barry. Also, I forgot to add that this was in April of 2011 when combat operations were over in Iraq. We were risking our lives to launch F-16s that were not carrying munitions. They were purely a show of force. That really rubbed me wrong and is probably the one incident that began my awakening process to what the U.S. military and our government actually were. And we went back and forth a little bit, and he followed up and he said, later, you touch on a lot of government bureaucracy, so you may find the rest of what happened that night useful. After the initial attack, I jumped up and sprinted about 200 yards to a bunker. The Air Force drilled tool accountability into our heads so much that when I was standing up to run, I grabbed my bag of tools. In the course of sprinting, the drill bit kit I was carrying opened and slung about half the drill bits out of the bag. When the attack and our post-attack perimeter sweep was over, I returned to my section. The aircraft I needed to pull stuck screws from had been damaged by shrapnel and had bigger problems. Long story short, the senior master sergeant I answered to was pissed off that I'd lost those drill bits. I spent the rest of my shift with a flashlight in the area I had ran through looking for those drill bits. I was not happy about this as my section was right next to the base perimeter fence and snipers were a real threat. That light made me a big, easy target. Once my shift was over and the new shift came in, I was ordered by the day shift senior master sergeant to return to where I had run and find the rest of the drill bits. After another hour, our squadron first sergeant caught risk wind of what was going on and put an end to the bullshit. I would have understood their concern if I had been on the actual airstrip where aircraft taxied, and there was a real risk of FOD. Since all my running was in the dirt 50 yards from the airstrip, and the actual airstrip was peppered with a lot of shrapnel during the attack, I thought it was ridiculous that I was looking for drill bits in the sand. It boiled down to senior leadership has to explain lost tools, and both my supervisors were yes men and did not want to look bad. That is just one of many examples of mindless policy I experienced in the Air Force. Well, that's one hell of a story, Barry. I tell you, it's amazing. It really puts things in perspective because you always, you know, the American people, you know, talk about sending troops to Iraq and, you know, these guys are over there for years and years and years and we've been in Afghanistan for 17 years and it doesn't really impact or affect anybody here at home. But, you know, these are real people, real Americans and real stories. And I'll tell you one thing, I'm just glad you made it home in one piece, buddy. And but thank you very much for sharing your feedback as far as some of the drawbacks of wearing your mags across your chest. And the reason why we're talking about all this stuff is just, you know, you have to learn to think for yourself, and you can't just look at Hollywood or Navy SEAL commandos and just emulate them, you know. And so it's good to think things through from our own situation. Now, another gentleman that offered some feedback is my buddy Jeff. And Jeff is a vet, and Jeff is he's very knowledgeable about firearms, about reloading, ammunition, tactics, anything of a tactical nature like that. He's a real go-to guy for that kind of stuff, and I always enjoy his feedback, even when he disagrees with me or things like that. And so I'd like to share Jeff's feedback on last week's episode as well. He said, I liked your pitch for the AR-15 and couldn't agree more. It was well thought out, presented, and sensible. Loved the Kipling stuff at the end. Read that as a child. Thank you. The first thing that popped into my head was this shows the difference in generations, because the generation that Jeff is from read Kipling as a child. And the current generation has no idea who in the hell Kipling is. Because, you know, the things that Kipling had to say, they're not politically correct, and we can't have that. It just shows just how far the country slid in that short of a time. Let me get back up on my perch here. It's getting windy and breezy up here. But Jeff continues, and he says, a note on the LBE, and that is where it's carried. We carry high, two pouches on either side, followed by a canteen. On hitting the dirt, we would pop the buckle so that all was out of the way. By carrying high, and by that I mean the top of the mag pouches are at elbow height, the pouches would form armrests for holding your weapon. Loaded mags went in upside down, empty mags would be loaded right side up. Also, we had mags taped. That's pretty common. Middle of the back on the LBE was left open so it wouldn't interfere with the ruck. We also squeezed in an old canvas M14 mag pouch for possibles, such as break free, camo stick, and bug dope. That's a half gallon of water and 14 magazines. You see, Tim, we really didn't want to run out of ammunition. First aid pouch was on the belt, off the shoulder straps. As a matter of fact, we kept everything off the shoulder straps because we were trained to fight a pair off either shoulder. Mag pouches and canteen covers were attached with both paracord and zip ties. So each pouch would have two zip ties and two segments of paracord. Very secure. The original clips went into the dumpster. Our concept was the LBE is for fighting and Alice is for comfort. So we would drop our rucks well before we got involved. The mags weren't such a big deal, but P-mags don't really work well in the old-style mag pouches, so mine would be the standard GI mags. Proven system. And just to take a break here, notice how he is tailoring his mags to his pouches. Once again, you can't just blindly follow what somebody says. You need to test your system out for itself. So to continue, he says, Tim, I can't stand the green tip stuff. Looks sexy, but that's about it. For business, other I would lean hard towards 45 grain VMAX or 50 grain varmint stuff. Works great and puts stuff down a lot better than that other fodder, especially considering the dense distances you work with. By the way, once you get past 250 yards, wounds from 5.56 get a lot more survivable. By the way, as an aside, a Red Ryder BB gun is a fantastic training aid for learning instinctive close quarter battle stuff that will save you a ton of money on ammo and can avoid having to get a range. Happy Easter. Be well. Now, I hope everybody listening to this understands the value of the advice and the real life experience you're getting from these gentlemen who have gone out of their way and taken their time to share their knowledge with us. And it's interesting, the stuff about the ammo, I can see exactly where he's coming from, because varmint stuff is going to be an explosive wound compared to the green tip, which is more penetrating. And once again, that comes down to where you're where you think your anticipated area of operations would be and all of that. But it just, you see, you have to examine all of this stuff and you have to think about it from all sides based on your situation and not just what somebody on the internet says. So I thought that was, let's see. Oh, and he followed up and he said, oh, I forgot, our canteens got dummy corded with about 3 feet of paracord. It's always when you've paused to hydrate a little that someone decides to take a shot at you and suddenly your priorities change. Yes. Isn't that the truth? It reminds me of a story my uncle told me. My uncle, John W. Stone, was in the Marines as a PFC in World War II, and he fought his way across the Pacific. And he was detailed one night to take his squad's canteens down to the stream and fill them up. What they would do is they would appoint one guy as canteen filler-upper, and he would take everybody's canteens to go down there. And that way, if he got killed, you only lost one guy, and you know, later on you go get your canteens or whatever. But he was down there filling canteens up, and a Japanese patrol came down the creek, and they were so close, they were literally going to step on him. There was no way to avoid them. They were literally going to step right on his body as he laid in the darkness there. And he waited till they got right up on him, and he told me, he said he knew he was going to die, but he pulled his .45 automatic out, and he shot him point blank, just muzzle to the chest, just one right after the other. And he said the surprise was so complete and total that the ones that he didn't shoot panicked, dropped their weapons and fled. And from that day forward, he was never without a .45 automatic. He had absolute, complete, total, supreme faith in the .45 automatic. And interestingly enough, he hated Japanese until the day he died. I had other uncles that fought the Germans in Europe, and they didn't have any problems, and they came home and they would tell me, you know, the Germans were good soldiers, and they fought hard, and when their commanders told them to surrender, they surrendered, and they didn't really have a problem with them. But the Japanese, that was a different story. My uncle, till the day he died, he would never buy anything made in Japan, and he considered them to be subhuman savages until the day he died. That's just it's just a fact of the matter. You know, that's just telling it like it was. So anyway, I appreciate everybody's feedback, and if you ever need to or feel the need to send me some feedback or agree or disagree or have suggestions for shows, hit me up, meattrapper@gmail.com. Now, another thing that I had recently talked about was President Trump and his signing the omnibus spending bill and how it pissed me off and had deflated my my faith in him. And I think a lot of people had that reaction. And I think that sort of took the Trump administration by surprise. And I think he realized he needed to do something to sort of shore up support a little bit. So it's interesting. We've had an interesting week. The military is being sent to the border. The National Guard is being sent down there. And the funny thing is all of the liberals are, you know, they're screaming bloody murder about, you know, Trump militarizing the border, even though President Obama dispatched the National Guard to the border as well. You know, nothing was said about that. And it's just funny. The capacity of these people for hypocrisy never ceases to amaze me. I mean, when Bush was president, you had no end to the anti-war protests and demonstrations and Code Pink and bring the troops home. And then as soon as Obama got in office, well, they all evaporated. You never heard from them again. There was never another anti-war protest, and Code Pink went away. And nobody had a problem with Obama invading Libya and killing Gaddafi and invading Syria. Not a problem. It's just interesting, isn't it? But and it's also interesting that only in America would liberals be in favor of sending American troops to Syria to invade and occupy a country who has never attacked us, and then be up in arms about using the military to defend our own border. If that's not insanity, I honestly don't know what insanity is. I mean, I can't give you another definition. It just, I don't know, it just boggles the mind, you know? But be that as it may, you know, that just goes to show that we can't control our country. We can't control our government. We can't control ourselves. We can control the weapons we purchase, the gear we purchase to go with them, how we rig it out, what ammunition we use. But even more fundamentally, we can control ourselves. And I've touched on this topic in the past, and I'm going to come back and revisit it tonight a little bit, simply because, to me, it's incredibly important. self-control. And one of the things that I have been focusing on lately is losing a little bit of weight. Actually, a little bit more than a little bit of weight. I took it as a goal a few weeks back to lose 30 pounds. And if I lose 30 pounds, I will be back to the weight that I was in college. I guess you'd call it your fighting weight, limiting or what have you. So far, I'm down 7 pounds and I have 23 to go. But as part of that, I've really been re-examining my exercise and my fitness regimen simply because I'm getting old. And like I mentioned when I was talking about doing yoga, it's getting to the point where my joints can't handle heavy weights anymore, heavy squats, heavy bench press. I break down. My joints and my cartilage breaks down. And so I've had to look at other options. And one of the things that I wanted to share was sort of a revelation or an understanding that I've come to regarding this sort of thing. And a lot of people will ask, you know, like if they decide that they're going to lose weight, the first thing they'll ask is, what diet should I get on? What exercises should I do? What program should I adopt? So they're looking for someone else to lay out a regimen or a routine or an instruction set or a list, a to-do list for them. And if they just go down and do that to-do list, then they will achieve success. Well, I took it a step further. And what I did is, instead of asking what diet should I be on, what food should I eat or not eat, what workout should I do or not do, I took it a step back. And the first thing that I went is way back to, what is it that I want to be able to do? And I want you to think about that. Because it depends on your goal. If your goal is to run a marathon, then once you know what your goal is, you know how to train for it. If your goal is to become a power lifter, you're going to train differently than if you're going to run a marathon or an Ironman or what have you. And more importantly, instead of a specific objective, like do this or do that, I decided that my goal, my functional fitness goal, was that I wanted to be able to move naturally as a human should be able to move, as a human was designed to move. Now, that's a pretty fundamental goal, but it's incredible how few people can actually do it. And when I started my sort of self-examination, I realized there were things that I could not do. And this was a very, very humbling realization. So I'm going to talk about one movement, one thing that a lot of people can't do. But it's a very fundamental, basic movement that the human being was designed to be able to do as part of being alive, and that is to squat. Now, I don't mean put a barbell across your back, put weights on it, and go halfway down and stand halfway back up or whatever. No, I'm not talking about the exercise, the squat. I'm talking about being able to squat down and stand up. It's astonishing how few people can actually do this. Now, I want you to think. Anytime you have seen film or footage or video of people from Asia, especially rural people, Vietnamese, people from Thailand, Burma, China, the one thing that you'll notice is these people will squat down and eat food. How many times have you seen Asians with a little bowl of rice or whatever and some chopsticks, and they will squat down where they're at, and they're when they squat down, they are flat on their feet. They're not up on the balls of their feet, okay? They're flat on their feet. Their legs are fully folded under, and it's a very restful, comfortable, natural position for them, and they can maintain it for extended periods of time, and they, you know, will eat and do whatever. And when they're done, they stand up and away they go. Now, you take an American and you give him a bowl of food and you tell him to squat down feet flat on the floor, eat his meal, and then stand up. And 90% of them either can't do it or they're going to be in pain when they try and stand back up. Think about that. It's an incredibly simple, basic movement. Squat down and stand up in comfort. Why is this a basic movement? Well, for one thing, it's how the human body was designed to defecate. When, you know, the human body was not designed with the modern toilet in mind. In fact, if you go to many countries, they don't have modern toilets like we have. They have a slit in the ground or a pit and you squat down over it because that's how you alleviate your bowels. You squat down. And there are many advantages to this because you're going to eliminate your bowels much more efficiently and effectively when you squat down than if you sit on a toilet. But of course, we, in our infinite modern wisdom, we know better than God. We know better than the Creator. Yeah, we're a lot smarter. And you can even buy a little thing called a squatty potty and put it in there. And it allows you to assume a squatting position over your modern toilet. Use your modern toilet. But anyway, the reason I'm getting into all this, I know this sounds crazy, I know this sounds insane, but what's amazing is you have a very simple movement, and it reveals so much that we lack. And so when I started, and you know, another thing is, for the military guys, there are, you know, most people are familiar with the different shooting positions. You have prone, where you're laying on your stomach, you know. You have kneeling, where you are kneeling on one knee. You can shoot in a kneeling position. They have a sitting position, standing position. Well, during the Vietnam War, a new position was sort of popularized and it came out, and it was called the rice paddy prone. The rice paddy prone, well, if you think about a rice paddy, it's an open field, it's full of water. And, you know, the military, in their infinite wisdom, would spread everybody out in a wide line, and they'd march them all the way across these wide-open rice paddies. And, of course, that's when the enemy would drop mortar rounds on them or start, you know, shooting at them or whatever. And you're in knee-deep water, so you can't go prone, or you're underwater. You can't breathe. You could kneel, but that's not a very steady shooting position. And it presents a large target compared to being prone. And so the rice paddy prone was where you would squat. You would assume that squatting position, like the Vietnamese would squat to eat. And you would rest your elbows on your knees. And if you were right-handed, you would angle your weapon a little bit to the left. And if you were left-handed, you would angle it a little bit to the right. And you had a very stable position to shoot from. I mean, it was a lot more stable than standing or kneeling, and it was very quick to get into. You could squat down immediately, squeeze off a few well-aimed rounds, and then you could stand up and run, move, you know, shoot and move. But once again, it's that squatting and standing up. So you see, this has a lot of different uses. And when I started in reinvestigating my fitness regime, I found that my lower back was tight. When I would try and squat down, I would feel it in my lower back. And then when I'd stand up, I would feel it in my hips. And I was like, this is crazy. What do I need? Why do I need to be doing bench presses? Why do I need to be doing push-ups if I can't comfortably squat down and stand up and run? You see, this is fundamental. It's going back to the very, very, very fundamental things. So before I worry about what diet should I be on, before I worry about how much should I bench press, before I worry about how many miles I should be able to run, how about I worry about if I can squat down, take a dump, and stand up without being in pain? That's it's called getting back to basics and common sense. And so you can take this as far as you want. If you're a hunter, a trapper, you know, what is it? What motions do you want to be able to perform safely, comfortably, effectively? What is it you're trying to do? And that's one of the things that I've really gained as far as my strength from doing yoga. And if you think about, like, let's say when I go to pick a beaver up out of the mud and carry him, that's not a balanced motion. I'm not doing a deadlift where I keep my back straight and I squat down and bend my knees and I lift with my legs and all of this crap, you know, in a gym. I'm in the mud on uneven ground and it's freezing cold and muddy and slippery, and I'm having to bend over at an angle and pick a heavy beaver up and then carry him. And that gets into your core strength, your obliques, and all of that. And you don't get that kind of training doing push-ups and bench presses and squats. So that's where I'm going with it. And it's just because we have to take care of ourselves. And I've preached and preached about eating meat, that we catch ourselves because it's so much healthier and it insulates us from the system. And if you can improve your strength and your conditioning and your flexibility to where you can get up and get around and not get hurt and not need those doctors and not need that Obamacare, that's what it's all about. And that's just as important in distancing yourself from a corrupt system as having weapons is, if not more so. Now, the last thing I'd like to talk about is the incredibly changed nature of our relationship with the law in this country. You see, the country that I was born in and grew up in and used to be loyal to was a country where the police enforced the law. And what that meant was is that there were laws on the books. You couldn't rob a bank. You couldn't print counterfeit money. You couldn't kill people for no reason. And if you broke those laws, the police would come and they would find out who did it, and then they would arrest them and they would put them in jail until they could be given a trial and their guilt or innocence could be determined and they could be punished or let loose. That's how it used to work. That's how it was supposed to work. Now, of course, it wasn't perfect. Wasn't perfect at all. You can ask black folks how perfect it was back in the 1950s. Wasn't that perfect, you know? But it wasn't completely corrupt. And more than corrupt, corruption is when you have a relationship that is subverted. And we have gone beyond corruption. We have changed the relationship between citizens and law in this country. And I want to give you an example of what I'm talking about, and then I want you to think about this as you go about your daily lives, and every time you get on the internet and read the news, I want you to think about this. There was a gentleman in California, and he was a YouTube blogger, and what he did is he would go to his local city council meetings, and he would film the meetings so that when a politician stood up and said, I'm going to do ABC, and then later they didn't do ABC, they did the opposite of ABC, he had them on footage, and he would try and hold their feet to the fire. Now, this was all 100% legal, because in his community they had what they called open-air laws. And that is, the citizens had the right to come to government meetings and they could record or photograph those meetings, okay? And the idea behind the open-air law is you can't have secret meetings. The government can't meet secretly. You know, city council can't all get together at Billy Bob's house and make decisions and take votes and nobody knows about it. And so this guy, that's what he did, is he would go and he was a community activist, and of course he was a conservative, and he would film these meetings and document all of this stuff. Well, they didn't really like it, you know. Imagine that. So what they did what the city council did is they voted to move their city council meeting to a federal courthouse building, a federal building. Now, the problem is that the federal building has a rule that when you enter the building, you go through the metal detector and you get searched, there are no cameras allowed in the federal building. So here you have a city council that's going to have a city council meeting, and the law says that you can't have any secrets and that you can bring cameras and you can record the meeting, but they have it in a place where they take your cameras away when you go through the door. Well, the guy didn't like this, and he said, look, you people are violating the law. The law says I can take a camera into the city council meeting. And the security guard said, well, our rule is no cameras in the building. So, of course, guess who ended up in handcuffs, and guess who ended up in jail? Not the security guards and not the city council. The guy with the camera. Now, he was cited with a ticket, but not charged with a crime. And the ticket was $85, and I forget what the ticket was written for, disturbing the peace or some crap like that. You know, they always have something. So anyway, he said, my rights are being violated. They're breaking the law. They're using this excuse to keep cameras away in spite of the law saying cameras can be in. I want a trial. I'm not going to pay the ticket. I want to go before a trial judge. So they had the trial, and of course he lost. You know, the judge was like, too bad, tough apples, bang, you're guilty. So it didn't matter what he said, didn't matter what the law said. And the interesting thing was the comments that the judge made to this gentleman in court. And it was fascinating because, let me see if I can find this article. Let me be patient 1 second. I should have had this already pulled up. But I think you'll find the comments of the judge fascinating. Let's see here. Let's see. Let's see. Magistrate Judge Jean P. Rosenbluth says she can understand why Mr. Gelena was angry and frustrated given his past experience filming the meetings, but she said that did not excuse his failure to follow orders. Failure to follow orders. Security at the appellate courthouse where justices could be filmed without their knowledge was a serious concern, the judge said. Even if these seem arbitrary or don't make any sense to Mr. Gelena or anybody else, they clearly serve this very important purpose, Rosenbluth said, finding Gelena guilty. And so the judge was very, very nice, and she ended up only fining him $85, the cost of the original ticket, blah-bitty-blah, blah-bitty-blah. But I want you to notice the language that the judge used, follow orders. Now, I want you to think about following orders. Who follows orders? Who gives and who receives orders? Well, if you've ever been in the military, you know that there is a chain of command, there's a hierarchy, there are people who are above other people. And the people who are above can give orders to the people who are below. And the people who are below must follow those orders or else. You have no choice. You must follow your orders or else. You cannot question your orders. You cannot disobey your orders. You must carry them out because they are issued by your superiors. Now, it's funny who's giving the orders here. You see, the police were giving the citizen orders. That tells you who's higher on the chain of command. And if you don't follow your orders, you get put in a cage. Now you see, it used to be that you had to break a law. You had to commit a crime in order to have handcuffs put on you and arrested. That was the whole arrangement. You steal from somebody, you kill somebody, you rob somebody, you do something to someone else, you harm someone else or harm property, and then the police put you in a cage. Now it's different. Now the relationship is different. Now they can give you orders, and if you do not obey, then you've committed a crime. The order of precedence of this is important to understand, because you used to commit the crime first, then they would give you orders. Put your hands up. Put your hands behind your back. But you had to do something first. Now you don't have to do something first. Now they can tell you, do this, and you are back in the military and you have to comply or else. What this shows is that the fundamental relationship between citizen and government has changed. Citizens are no longer in charge of the government. The government is in charge of the citizens. I don't think that was how it was meant to be. So you see, there are a lot of reasons. There are a lot of reasons why we have to be independent. We have to start with ourselves. We have to look at ourselves, take charge of ourselves, take charge of those around us, be responsible for ourselves, be aware of ourselves, and be ready to help each other. Because otherwise, we are on our own, and you don't want to be there. So anyway, I hope this has been useful. I appreciate everybody's feedback. If you have anything to add, yay or nay, meattrapper@gmail.com. And I am quite chilly. At least the rain has lifted a little bit here. So I'm going to pack everything up and keep on hiking. Because one of my little things, in addition to being able to squat down and stand back up, one of my little measures is that I like to be able to walk 10 miles without issue. And so that's one of my little things that I do every, I don't know, I don't have much time anymore. Every second or third month, I'll go out and start hiking. And my goal is to simply be able to walk 10 miles without being dead, you know, wiped out or what have you. And, you know, so that's what I'm doing today. I'm about halfway portion done. It's time to sort of turn around and get back out before dark. Got another 2 hours or so before the sun sets. And I've done the uphill portion. Now I'm going to do the downhill portion. Thanks for listening. We'll see y'all next time.
The battle cry goes like this.